Okay, Ted Mullen. Ted is a graduate student.
I have just finished being a graduate student. Woo-hoo! 3 weeks ago. So I'm a postdoc now at D-Lab. About 90% of blind people live in developing countries. It's a World Health Organization statistic. As you know, Braille typewriters cost upwards of $400 or $500. The Perkins is about $700. Refreshable Braille displays on the order of $2,000 and up, or $100 per character. These devices are not accessible to most blind people. When we're talking worldwide, let's just assume that all early blind people, well, most of them don't read Braille, but they should be. These devices have not been accessible, and the barrier isn't technological complexity. We've been to the moon, and you know, everyone has microwave ovens, and raised dots just are not a challenge. So the challenge is something other than technological complexity. Louis Braille's slate and stylus is still the standard, right? So in 1840, the devices that most people were using to write Braille, Louis Braille and a couple of other people, were more or less the same device that most people who Braille today are using. In that sense, the technology has been stagnant. So the first point is basically most early blind people worldwide are illiterate and unemployed, and I think that there is certainly a correlation there. I would argue that the inaccessibility of Braille devices is largely responsible. Well, the project that I'm working on is called the Blind Lead Initiative. Blind lead as in the blind lead the blind. The objectives are twofold. First of all, to develop and disseminate low-cost blind assistive technologies, focusing initially on Braille and tactile literacy. Just as importantly, focusing on sustainability. And the way that I think that this can work is to develop a blind accessible design and construction paradigm to empower blind individuals to pick up and continue the legacy of Louis Braille in very literal sense, to continue to develop the technology. Very quickly, I mean, Louis Braille, right, I mean, born in 1809, blind from the age of 3, developed Braille between the ages of 12 and 15. So this is a phenomenal technology developed by a blind child 2 centuries ago. Not only did he develop Braille, but by the age of 20, he developed the musical notation, he developed a mathematical notation, and envisioned mechanical Braille devices. So Perkins didn't invent Braillers. Louis Braille envisioned them, worked on them with a schoolmate of his, another blind fellow named Pierre Foucault, and Foucault created the first, basically the first Brailler, the Raphograph. Braille technology starts with blind people and gets pretty darn far with just blind people. And that's the Raphograph was 1840, 1850, somewhere between 1890 and let's say 1930. They developed this massive variety of, some of them you'd call typewriters, some of them, you know, were odd crab-shaped things which you used to put Braille on paper, but look nothing like typewriters. But there was this huge diversity of technology, which when you get to post-World War II has seemingly just disappeared. And you can go and visit some of it in the Perkins Museum, and there's information about some of these devices on the web. But, you know, from 1950 until today, Perkins Brailler has been the dominant Brailler. And I want to stress the difference between the Perkins and the devices that were prevalent between 1890 and 1930, 1940. Most of those early devices, if you put your hands on them, you can feel the mechanism. So although sighted people had kind of picked up this technology and developed it and started to, you know, approach mass production, you could still see the mechanism and you could feel the mechanism. The Perkins Brailler from the very first has been a tank. It's a closed design. It's impenetrable to eyes. It's impenetrable to fingers. And it's designed very much that way. You could have a brilliant blind person who is determined to figure out how the Perkins works and has screwdrivers and wrenches and pliers, and they will never figure out. They might be able to get it apart. They'll never get it back together. So that's me speaking from experience as a sighted person who has a Perkins Brailler disassembled on my living room floor. It's not just something which evolved this complexity. It has this complexity intentionally in order to protect the brand. So when it breaks, you send it to an authorized repair center. It's also designed very well. You know, in addition to having 700 custom parts, it breaks less often than most brailers. But the difference is a circa 1900 brailer, if it breaks, you bring it to the hardware store, and the guy at the hardware store can probably fix it for you. Perkins brailer, not a chance. It's not a complicated technology. When it comes down to it, what the Perkins brailer is doing is not anything advanced beyond the device that Louis Braille and Pierre Foucault developed. It's a stronger package and a much more impenetrable package. These technologies discourage users from considering the operation. In order for the technology to be developed further, the users have to know the technology, the users have to have insight into the technology. And so with that, I'll get to an actual new technology. So for the past year and a half, I've been working on a few devices. The one that's farthest along is called a Braillet Labeler. A very simple concept. It's a handheld mechanical device, no electronics. And the first one I developed was used to emboss Braille onto Scotch tape, just regular office tape. The second model I developed was for embossing onto vinyl tape, so Dymo tape. And it's a six-button device, right, so no big wheel, so it's language independent. The goal was to keep it to common hardware, simplest design possible, and the central point is not only can it be built from common hardware and very cheaply, but it can be built by blind people. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass around two versions of the device, or two carcasses of versions of the device. And about a year ago, I went to Tamil Nadu, India, and I set up a workshop where an initial group of five blind gentlemen were trained to develop the device. So we started with the one which is on my left, eventually, with feedback from them and a lot of interaction, I've been back to India twice, we developed it into the device that's now on the right side of the room from where I'm sitting. At some point, I switched over from the Scotch tape idea. Even though Scotch tape is cheaper, vinyl tape holds Braille better. Trying to improve the device, trying to simplify the device. About a month ago, during a Skype conversation with the group in India, towards the end of the conversation, one of the workers took out a device that he'd built, and it was a hybrid of the two devices. I will pass two of these around. Yeah. Well, what you're feeling over there is the first version of the device, and it has, you'll feel it has wheels, and it has the six buttons. I'm talking to the group in Tamil Nadu, and one of the workers who's, just a really, really great manual dexterity, and we have a lot of trouble communicating because his native language is Tamil, but he communicates through their supervisor that he's built a device, and it's a hybrid of the two devices that I passed around first, the open ones. He took the mechanisms that he found easiest to build from the two devices, and he made one which works as well as either of the devices, which he's able to build easily. And that is now what they're building in the workshop. So I went out there, for me it was an experiment, and I would very much like to start up these construction workshops all over the place, but they are determined to actually produce the device for distribution. They want to produce it to sell. So we've been working to get the process down as simple as possible so that they can make on the order of 100 per week and sell them for the equivalent of about $5, $8 a piece. Out in Tamil Nadu. I think we now have a first generation device which they can produce in Tamil Nadu. We can produce in other workshops as we start them up. We could go into mass production, but I have a feeling that this is still far from an optimal device. So as the completed ones make their way around, I would really appreciate your feedback on them.
Describe how you're supposed to hold it and what the functions of the I saw it looked like two sets of three on the finished model push buttons.
Yes.
So I need to know which way to hold it. I think I know, but and then how those correspond to which dots, etc., etc.
The way that I intended for it to be held, of course, was not the way that most people hold it when they first pick it up. The way to hold it, honestly, is how it's most comfortable. The important thing to know is how the buttons correspond to dots 1 through 6. It is when you push up on a button, it pushes up on a pin which is in the corresponding position. So if you hold the device with the buttons on top, it's as if you're punching down into the tape. And on each one, I've brailled a couple of words on the tape coming out of it. So you can feel what the orientation is with respect to the buttons. Other than that, please feel free to press the buttons. Now, on the complete devices, there's also a knob on the side, and you turn that knob to advance the tape. So if you feel the tape and turn the knob, the tape will go in one direction or the other. Turn the knob in the direction that causes the tape to advance.
If you're holding it so that the tape is coming out from the left side of the device, the knob is actually the one single thing on the front.
So if you hold the device with the buttons on the bottom and the tape facing away from you, button one, corresponding to pin one, is on the top right. But the best way to...
I would turn it the other way.
Yeah, I would too, with the way that... He showed it to me.
When you write one character with this device, does it automatically advance the tape?
No, so it does. It does not. And I've had versions that do, and the ratchet mechanism turns out to be, at the moment, turns out to be more of a pain for the workers to produce than I thought was worthwhile. And so this was all a balance between what's going to be most convenient for the user and what's going to enable a blind person to build the device in real time. The workers in India in particular want to build enough to actually be able to sell them and sustain the workshop.
So they don't. It's not important to them that, for example, you might end up with a label where you have spaces between some of the dots or uneven spaces between the dots.
Okay, they want even space. They want readable Braille, of course. To have Braille spacing is key. The device doesn't self-advance, but when you turn the knob, you feel the tape increment.
Okay.
And it increments in Braille spacing.
Okay, so it clicks or something.
Now, do you push more than one button at a time?
On the original device that used Scotch tape, you could. And so the buttons you'll feel are kind of arranged in two triangular conformations.
Yes.
My thinking was, okay, you can operate all of the buttons with two fingers, right? You can hit any combination of one set of three buttons with one finger, any combination of the other set of buttons with another finger. With the vinyl tape, you need to hit one button at a time. That's the way it is right now. That might change when I change the embossing surface. But right now, if you press two buttons, if one of the pins is slightly higher than the adjacent pin, that pin wins. It lifts the tape away from the second pin. The Braille needs to be precise. There's no getting around that. But everything other than the Braille in this device has been designed so that you can be off by a little bit.
Does this take the half-inch tape or the 3/8-inch tape, or what's the design?
Current device takes the half-inch tape. I think 3/8 is going to be more practical in terms of cost. You don't need half an inch. I started out with half-inch because I really didn't know how well they'd be able to assemble the advance. I didn't know if Braille is going to start at the top of the tape and move to the bottom of the tape, then you're going to have to readjust. But at least one of those devices that's going around seems to advance pretty straight, and 3/8 will be possible.
Now, is there a mechanism on the device to cut the tape, or how do you get the tape off?
Okay, so with the Scotch tape, it was very easy. They made an edge of aluminum jagged, and they tore the tape off, and
right.
It was great. With the vinyl tape, you need a scissors. Now, that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable to me. It's unacceptable to the workers. No one wants to have to carry around the scissors. What I'm thinking for that is a can opener type mechanism. I don't want them to have to be putting a razor blade in each one or making a razor blade. They could do it, but there would inevitably, with 100 devices, there would be accidents. But with just two wheels that move relative to each other, you should be able to have like a can opener type cutting mechanism very simply and cheaply
to
cut the tape.
Here we use these types of devices for labeling our spice jars and things like that. Well, yeah, how would they use it as their primary literacy device?
It's not their primary literacy device, it's their primary labeler, which I don't think that we have right now. We have a large device which was invented about 35 years ago, in which a couple of companies have produced exactly the same. It was not invented for Braille. It was invented with the English alphabet around the saucer, and it was adapted for Braille. clearly not optimal, not useful to anyone who doesn't use the English alphabet. This is a pocket-sized device. This is a small device. It goes in your pocket. It comes with you to the supermarket. You take it out. You write, peas. You label your can, and you have a can of peas that's labeled. You label your microwave buttons. You label, whatever you acquire during the day. You write down contact information. In my view, labeling should be something which is easy and frequently performed.
So the dots in the triangle, say one side would be 1, 2, 3, correct?
Yes.
1, 2, let's say 3 is the one that's, the edge of the triangle. I'd press one dot, then 2, and then 3, and then advance it to get my letter?
So if you want the letter L, you would press 1, 2, and then 3, and then you would advance it, and you'd have the letter L. So I think that it's a pretty obvious device which should exist already. And moreover, I think that it should cost about $10. $10 in the United States means a lot less than $10 overseas. So if Americans were willing to pay $15, then for every one they buy, they could donate one overseas. And I don't think that people here would notice the difference between $10 and $15 when it comes to a Braille device. But my foremost concern is that this doesn't become a $70 device just because it can't.
I would say you want to stick with anything under $20, just like the TV does, 1995.
Well, I want to stick with what it's worth, and I want it to be clear to the user that this is a simple mechanical device and that the technology was developed by blind people, and that this is a technology of blind people, not something which is arbitrarily made by the cited commercial forces whenever they see.
The people that this is being marketed to, do they have a slate inside us usually or not?
The workers in the shop in Tamil Nadu had slate and stylus, although they didn't have it with them. They all knew Braille. And slate and stylus were not something that were easy to come by, so they didn't carry it with them. They had it at home.
Not only that, how representative were they of the larger population of blind people in that area?
So I've known them for a year now, and I'm getting the impression they were not horribly representative. I think that they were, they're exceptionally capable people who have gone through various types of training. One of them is a classically trained singer. Both of them, of the ones who've been there from the start, have undergone a bookbinding training. I mean, that they're knowledge sponges. And so the typical blind person in India does not know Braille. But I think that can change.
Suppose I'm in a developing country. Where do I get the tape? How much do I pay for it?
The Scotch tape was the answer to all of this, because Scotch tape is available locally in a lot of developing areas.
Is that still under active consideration for
us? I haven't thrown away Scotch tape. Scotch tape poses problems in that if you get a little nick in the corner, you need to open the device up and reload your tape.
It's also not durable.
So the Braille can be durable if you double it over. Unless 3M introduces, another tape that's twice as thick, I think doubling over Scotch tape would be okay. It's just a question of getting the device to do that easily. So that's still under development. Dymo tape is less common, and it is available. 3M makes a version. It will be available in the Tamil Nadu region. But I'd like to establish, in the coming year, I'd like to establish several additional workshops in the developing world, and hopefully one here in Cambridge. Dymo tape is not naturally available everywhere. Yeah. I'll be bringing it in. It will be distributed through the workshop.
I still like the idea of the slate and stylus, because if you have a small slate, then you can just, use paper and make labels that way. And then use some glue or something like that. So, and you could also have slots to put in Dymo tape.
When's the last time you did that?
Maria, I used to Braille with a slate, stylus labeling all the time. It's very unreliable.
Yeah.
It's very difficult, and it requires a lot of pressure. For anybody with difficulty with their hands, it does not work real well. Sliding the tape through creates its own problems. This way, the tape's already in. You don't have to worry about the tape curling. You don't have to worry about it falling out of the slots.
I just want to say that I think this is a really good idea. Not only does it promote Braille literacy, which is down, but it also, blind people are designing it. And I don't know, I think it's a really ingenious idea.
For older people, it's much easier to use than this.
Yeah.
I think one thing you'd have to do, you'd need to have some kind of instruction, because an orientation, because it's, as you said, most people don't hold it at all the way you think they would, and you have to, and for this kind of thing to work, you'd have to have some kind of instructional material available, because it's not going to be helpful if somebody buys it or gets it given to them, they look at it for 10 minutes, they don't know how to work it, and they throw it down.
Right. So I've had the experience. I mean, I sent one of the early prototypes to one of the founders of Braille Without Borders, and she said thank you. And I went and visited her a few months later, and she had it in the drawer and had never produced one letter with it, just because she hadn't figured out how it advanced. And she's a genius. The idea that you need instruction, either brailled instruction or personal instruction, is absolutely true, absolutely essential. I'd like for the device to initially spread via person to person, rather than ordering this, having it come in the mail with professional instructions as a typical commercial device. I really want this to be a technology which is embedded within the world blind community in multiple places, and for the technology to continue to be developed. So I think the worst possible scenario is that, I come back and look in 30 years and these devices are out there and they look exactly like they do today. That would be awful. It's not an optimized device. It's not a refined device. The pattern I've seen is that when 3M or whoever produces a Braille device, they go through one cycle of development and either it sinks or it swims, and that's how the device stays. The goal for this device is for it not just to survive on the market, but for it to be refined by a subset of users. And you can go through a first production run when the technology warrants a production run, get feedback from users on that production run, then go through a second one after you've refined it further.
Your principles are laudable, but I would say pragmatically, perhaps not for the developing world. Maybe there, I'm not familiar enough to comment on that. Perhaps there you can do it person to person. My own experience is that for the most part, people are going to order this from somewhere and they're going to get it in their mailboxes and they're going to try to play with it and contact other people. The internet is your friend in that regard. You could set up a mailing list or you could do some podcasts on it, but you're going to need some instruction, because the reality is that transportation is an issue for most people who are blind.
Oh, of course.
The going person to person, as warm and fuzzy as that is, may not be practicable for many people.
But I guess my answer to you is an extension of the device needs to be refined. Not just the device needs to be refined, the method of dissemination needs to be refined, the instructions need to be written and put out there, and then, when half the population doesn't understand the instructions, they need to be revised and maybe, written in different languages, and that's something which I really would like to see happen or be initiated within the blind community.
Sure, no, agreed.
As opposed to having people like me or even worse, random executive types guessing what would be suitable for the blind, because they tend to get it wrong.
No, I agree with you. I'm just saying I think you need to have, for somebody to get this in their hands, I want them to be able to use it, and they're going to need an initial set of instructions.
Well, I think the idea of the model here, which I think is pretty neat, whether it's India or Africa, rather, is essentially the artisan, and you see that a lot in Africa and other places, the blacksmiths or whatever, they are the promoters of their technology. Mm-hmm. So they're going to get it to people. And the Western model, like you're saying, Amy,
that's what I'm saying. That's why I won't even begin to discuss an Eastern model.
But it's the local artisans who are going to be the promoters. I'm
hoping one or two or three of the local artisans might even be here in this room. In which case, I'm quite serious about starting up an accessible workshop at D-Lab. I have most of the equipment already, and I'd like to start bringing people through just to show them what an accessible workshop is in my mind and what it takes to create these, some of the processes. And I'd like to find a group of people, be it two people or five people or 10 people from the Boston area blind community who would like to come in and learn how to make these. And then they presumably will come into a meeting like this with several devices and show everyone how to use them and brainstorm about how to make a whole lot of them. So
how do we do that? How can we? I think there are people. I heard enough people in this group already say yes.
Yeah.
Okay. How do we? How do you want to initiate that?
So if people could email me, so you have my email, Amy.
I do. I will send it out.
You know, if 15 people are interested, I'll have three or four sessions, and the initial session will just be an introductory session where I introduce you to the device, to the construction processes, and after the initial session, we will figure out who's interested in continuing, who's interested in learning how to build the device completely, who wants to make five of them for themselves and their friends. But I'm interested in working with whoever here would, and you know, if you know others who would be interested.
Is this effort going to be able to protect itself so that it remains essentially open source, so that nobody like buys it up and makes it very difficult for other people?
The way that this stays open source is that it's put into the public domain. So I haven't published this yet, and the reason I haven't published this is because, for me, it's never finished. I can never say, I would use this thing, because I don't use Braille. So I can never, you know, say, this is worth writing up and putting the instructions out there. Although, to some extent, I've written up elements of the instructions and started to open source it, and then we changed the design. And the way that this becomes basically so that no one can patent it is that I write an article and describe the concept and several of the designs, and then just open source the schematics. At that point, it should not be possible for someone to come along and patent the technology and say you can't build it. In any case, if you're not doing it for profit, no one with a patent can stop you.
It is like a Creative Commons license, right?
So I intend to Creative Commons. But it's important that extensions of this, though, so stuff that, you know, people come into the workshop, and after you've been there for a year, you'll develop something new. And if it's, you know, something which is uniquely useful to you as a blind person, it might be new. It might be really something which is patentable. I'd like to keep, you know, everything which is directly derived from this device and other devices that I'm working on open source, but when you develop something new, you could patent that. That's something which I think that the community should at some point discuss.
How comfortable are you that you won't run into a patent trap where you really spread it around and somebody says,
okay, that's my patent? Well, so I, with regard to patents, I am as uncomfortable as one could possibly be. I can't tell you how many times I've described this work, and you know, the first response from an audience member is, you have to patent this, you have to patent this now. And I guess that's the good audience member, because the other one is out there trying to patent it.
Are you open to patent?
If you type Braille into the search engine of the United States Patent Office database, there's no lack of Braille inventions. All of those concept Braille devices that you hear about, that you read about, those are all patented. It seems to me that you know, Braille plus patent is more or less a death sentence at this point in time. I don't think that always has to be the case, but at least until a reasonable fraction of the early blind population is actively using Braille, I don't think that patents really have a role to play. I think that patents are what have gotten us into this mess, where in 1950, 50% of Americans used Braille, and today it's down to something like 10%.
Are you okay with defensive patents?
Am I okay with them? I don't want to pay for them, and I don't want to put them into somebody else's hands. There's a lot in the think tank, and I mean, I think I sent out a survey a couple of months ago about the low-cost Braille printer, which I appreciate very much. Those of you who got back to me, provided feedback on the printer. Based on that feedback, I've taken it in a somewhat different direction, which I think I probably shouldn't start to describe, because that could take a while.
Are you working on a Braille writer? I mean, a low-cost Braille writer, is that another down the road? Is that
so one thing I started in collaboration with Braille Without Borders is a low-cost Braille typewriter. I mean, I'd started on independently a few years ago, and they visited, and they had their version. And what we all want is to produce something which isn't just a nice concept, but which can actually be produced at very low cost. And so that's something which I'd like to get MIT students involved with in the coming months.
Quick thing, can you tell us, why don't you get a better handle on the parameters of what you can do and what hours and so forth, and send me an email with that outline, and then I will disseminate it to the group and have people sign up.
Sounds
send
good.
Back to you. Well, this is terrific. Thank you so much. There's a lot of interest. So I've asked Mecca to talk about Twitter, and maybe you can talk a little bit about how we might use Twitter and how that can be helpful for people.
Well, thanks, Amy, and good afternoon, everyone. For demonstration purposes, I'll be talking about Twitter and other types of new media communications, mostly focusing on Twitter, but I'll give you some idea of also kind of what's out there and what people are using for the most part. And then as far as a quick demonstration, I have the iPhone and a speaker and an Apple wireless keyboard, so we can do a quick demonstration. So as far as new media and communications, it kind of started out with blogging and podcasting, but I'd say that three services now that you'd want to get familiar with, whether this is for yourself or your organization or your company, would be Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. Those are the three services that you're mostly hearing about, and that there's a lot of focus in the sort of new media community and in business and entrepreneurial companies and kind of companies and organizations that are hip to this kind of space. And you tend to be better off with these services if you sign up and get an account early on, even if you're not going to be using it every day, because if nothing else, the name that you want on one of the services will get taken if you're kind of a latecomer to it. And especially also the kind of the length of time that you've been there is often shown in your profile for one of these. I'd encourage all of you personally, and for any organizations or businesses that you represent and can influence, to get accounts on all of those services, even just to set them up, even if you're not going to be using them as much as you might in the future. Just as far as in the room, how many people in the room use Twitter? Say aye.
Aye.
And how many don't?
Aye.
So there is a good number, and I know a lot of the people in the room using Twitter. So Twitter is basically a micro-blogging service. Like any of these online new media communication services, you start out by setting up a profile. In the case of Twitter, that would just be going typically with a desktop or a laptop computer to twitter.com and the sign-up process. The sign-up is somewhat accessible. It's probably not the best experience in terms of if you're using JAWS, for instance, you may have to use the virtual cursor to kind of know what some of the fields are, and it uses an audio captcha that you'll probably want a quiet space or headphones to actually.
Is it the Chinese man?
It's kind of a garbled cap, one of those. I remember we were doing it with the NFB Youth Slam. We really had to try it several times and get sort of a quiet place in order for it to work. So the basic profile items are things like your name, location. So, for instance, an organization with like Vibug would just put Boston, Massachusetts, you know, maybe USA. It's an open-ended field. You have your username and your name, which are different. So if Vibug can get Vibug, that would be good.
Yeah, we have Vibug Boston. Vibug was already taken.
But do you know as far as Vibug?
Somebody has Vibug already. It was taken already. The guy hasn't used it much, from what I can tell.
Okay.
But he still has it locked up.
Yeah, you might be able to.
The next, 8 months. So we're kind of watching to see when it becomes available.
Yeah, I found my Twitter username is my last name, Pikela, and I've been trying to get Mika because it's a lot easier to tell people, and it's a similar
spell.
It's a similar case where somebody has it, but they're not really using it, and I've occasionally contacted that person, and maybe someday I'll be able to get it. I mean, Vibug Boston is fine. I'd say it's better probably with no spaces or underscores, just because on mobile devices it's a little easier to type. But if you could, and in the future, get Vibug, that would be good as well. So you have that username. It's usually a company name or the person's name, or it can be anything. You can change it as well, and if you change it, you don't actually lose your followers. It just changes your username. So you have your username, your name. So in an organization like Vibug, in the name you might want to put like visually impaired and blind user group. You have a bio field, which you kind of describe what the group does in a couple of sentences. There's a character limit for that. And as we said, the location. There's also a field for a picture. And I'd say for individuals and organizations, especially if you have a logo or a good picture, it is generally considered good form on any of these social networks to add your picture. For those of us who are blind, it's kind of challenging if you don't have a recent digital photo, but people kind of frown upon it if you're on a social network and you don't have your picture up there. And in fact, with some social networks, you're limited in terms of the features that you can participate in without your picture. So I would just get someone to take a decent digital pic. You know, usually for something like this, it's just a headshot. I had our company webmaster take it in the lobby of our building with a brick wall in the background, and that's my Twitter and Facebook picture. So you have this profile that's almost like anything else that you set up. And then your tweets are posts, if you will, that are limited to 140 characters each. So that's a sentence or two, but you have to really kind of briefly make your post. And often people will link to URLs in those posts. So you have your profile in the posts, and then with Twitter, you have people that follow you. So once you get started, you would tell people to follow Vibug Boston or at Vibug Boston on their Twitter accounts. So that way, if you're a subscriber to Twitter and let's say you're following 25 accounts, which is probably about the average, if not even a little bit less, then you would see a timeline, and I'll demonstrate this, of the posts from those accounts. So people, for instance, with Vibug, you probably want to post, you know, when the next meeting is and the topic. Someone can pull up Vibug Boston in any Twitter client, whether it be on a mobile phone or a computer, and I would think one thing people would really want to know is just the date and time of the next meeting and what the top new people might benefit, especially with the date and time that don't know, but especially the topic. So you don't have to go to the website. You can just look up Vibug Boston and see what the next topic is really quickly from your mobile phone or your Windows or Mac PC or possibly even other devices.
Mika, some of our topics are somewhat involved in the description of what they are, so you don't
have to make a cryptic description.
Yeah, you have to have a pretty cryptic description, but and yet one that would also be quite descriptive.
Once you get to kind of working on it, then it's pretty, you get good at kind of abbreviating it. So you know, for instance, with this one, you could post grad student presentations and presentation about Braille device, for, you know, something along those lines. Or if it's a more a standard presentation that's a longer one, then it would be easier, obviously. You can also link to people's Twitter accounts within your tweet. So they refer to that as an at mention or an at reply. If there was a presenter presenting, you could say, you know, presentation or PRESO by, you know, for instance, at, is yours A Rule, Amy, or Amy Rule?
What?
Your Twitter.
It's ARULL, yeah.
Yeah, so presentation by at A Rule about the iPhone 5.
Yeah.
So that way, someone's reading that, they can click on at A Rule and look at Amy's Twitter account. Or it could be, you know, if it's a Freedom Scientific or a company that has a Twitter account, you could put presentation by at Jonathan Mosen regarding.
And it's the at sign.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly.
I want to make sure people know that. It's not AT.
So yeah, the at sign followed by a name is sort of a way of linking one's Twitter account to the post. And again, you'll hear that called an at mention or a reply. And it will notify that person within the Twitter client that they're being mentioned or replied to. And it's a kind of a one-to-many conversation. So, for instance, with my Pikula account, I could say, you know, going to at Vibug Boston meeting about whatever the topic is. And then everybody would be able to see that. And if someone didn't know what Vibug Boston was, they could click on that at Vibug Boston and your screen reader would tell you that it's a link of sorts to another Twitter account. And then they could read the bio, you know, that information we filled in earlier with the profile, as well as the recent tweets. So just to give you an idea as far as what tools or clients you would typically use to access this, there is the twitter.com website as well as a mobile version. But I would say most people use alternative clients, although you can certainly kind of get by using the Twitter website. I used it for the longest time, but there are sometimes clients that provide sort of a faster and more efficient way. What I'll be showing on the iPhone is a program called Tweetlist, and it allows you to have multiple accounts. So Amy, for instance, could have her A Rule account and her Vibug Boston account and easily switch between them and see various, if someone posted kind of just a mention of Vibug or had a question, she'd be able to get notifications on her phone of that and be able to respond all through the iPhone. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of iPhone Twitter clients, and voiceover users tend to like Tweetlist, but there are many. Echo Phone is another popular one, and the actual Twitter client is another that people use. On the PC side, I'd say a lot of people use a program called Quitter.
Which is not going to be developed anymore, did you hear that?
I did, but it still works.
Yeah, and it still works. Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if the development kind of comes back either with the gentleman or someone else. Hopefully it was just kind of a transient thing. So get it before the site gets taken down or something at quitter-client.net. Again, quitter-client.net. And essentially that allows you to run this program Quitter on your PC. It kind of runs in the background and you use largely the control and Windows key to interact with it, along with the arrows and some keyboard shortcuts. So in its basic sense, if you wanted to read through a list of tweets, you would hold control Windows, and then when you press the down arrow, it would read the tweets. Or if you press the right arrow, it would move through different buffers or lists within Twitter, like your timeline, which is everything, or your favorites, or your replies or mentions, or your direct messages. But then when you lifted up those keys, you'd go back to Internet Explorer or Word or whatever you were in, and it would be as if the program wasn't there. So it's kind of always there in the background, and you can get it by using those modifier keys. As far as I know, it only works with JAWS, because I think it uses JAWS scripting to some extent. Another more accessible way of interacting with Twitter people use is a website called EasyChirp. Again, that just takes the Twitter.com content and puts it in a more accessible and usable web interface for a screen reader user using the Twitter API. Again, kind of creating a more accessible website. There's also a number of Mac clients that people use. Ufukuru is one, and there's a couple of other clients on the Mac. And of course, they're easier to get now that you have the Mac App Store and you can kind of download them from one location.
Does Twitter still work? Because I know the Braille Plus has a client. Do you know if that still works with Twitter or no?
They did make some changes to their authentication scheme where basically you never give the client your password. You give your password through Twitter and it kind of sends the client a token. So I'm not sure if Level Star and APH change that. Some Twitter clients have kind of died off as a result of that change. For instance, I don't think the program that Jamal wrote, which was a Twitter interface, has been updated for that new authentication method. So I'm just going to show you now Tweetlist on the iPhone, and you'll probably get a better feel for kind of how the service sounds and works just by hearing it.
This
is the Jambox speaker here.
Phone, page 1 of 11, adjustable.
Beautiful.
Quora, newsstand, Foursquare, level up, Tweetlist. Double tap to open.
This is the Tweetlist app, so I'll just open that.
Tweetlist, Hyatala, accounts, back button. selected. Home, 74 items.
So down on the bottom, these are the main kind of tabs or categories.
Selected. Home, 74 items. Tab.
The home tab shows your timeline, so that's all the people that you're following on Twitter. You'll be able to read their posts under home.
Tweet lists. Tab. 2 of 5.
Tweet lists. That uses the Twitter lists feature. So let's say you were following 1,000 users, you could divide them into different lists and just filter the tweets based on the lists.
Mentions, tab, 3 of 5.
When I heard 74 items, what was that?
Home, 74 items.
74 recent items in the home timeline.
That's posts. So he's got 74 posts he's gotten recently.
How recent is recent? And the reason I ask is like this whole business of just the huge volume of stuff on
unless you follow a lot of people, you won't have the huge volume. Like, I think the average Twitter user follows somewhere between 12 and 24. So you won't really have that problem unless you're following a lot. So
probably follow a couple hundred?
I have several thousand. So I don't really use the home tab much.
74 items was in the last 2.5 years.
Probably, yeah. So, but if you're just getting started, you're not going to be in that predicament. But I sometimes use the home and we'll try it just to get a random set. You know, sometimes I'll stumble across things. I mostly don't use the home screen, and I'll show you know, what I use. So the lists, you could segment everything off, and so you could have a list of your friends and just put, say, 12 people on that list, and then you would only see their tweets.
Mentions, tab, 3 of 5.
The mentions are, again, when someone put the @ next to your username.
DMs, 143 items, tab, 4 of 5.
The direct messages, that's when someone sends you a private message, and you can also send private messages.
More, tab, 5 of 5.
And the more tab, which I'll open up.
Selected. More. Tab. 5 of 5.
That allows you to save searches, to look up a specific username, and to do various other things.
Microfile. So. Drafts. Favorites. Retweeted by me.
A retweet is when someone posts your tweet again, and kind of when someone does it, it starts out with RT as you're reading it. So, like, if someone finds something interesting, they could retweet what you said, and it would go to their followers. So it's kind of
like
how
forward in email.
Kind of, yeah.
Kind of.
It's kind of a way of spreading information.
Retweets of me. Search. Go to @ username.
You can go to a username.
Save searches. Heading. Number 11Y.
So another concept in Twitter is a hashtag. All that is using a number sign and then a series of letters. So it could be about a topic or an event or...
Number A11Y.
This one is number A11Y, which is a shortcut for accessibility. There's 11 letters between the A and the Y. And again, you're trying to save characters, so that helps people save characters in writing accessible. So people post to that hashtag about accessibility-related topics. So it's not a username. It's kind of like a bookmarking mechanism. When you're posting a Vibug meeting, you could, if you had space in your tweet, you could use number A11Y. So people that are looking at that hashtag know that it's about accessibility. So I'll click on that right now, the number A11Y hashtag, and it's going to bring
number
up.
Back button.
It's going to bring up the most recent tweets where people have used that hashtag to talk about accessibility. Regarding accessibility, some people also use number AXS, and some people use number accessibility, and some people use number A11Y. So you could check all of them, or, you know, a lot of times people use more than one, but just there's no authority that says you have to use number A11. It's just kind of a practice. So
I'll let you just make these things up as they go along?
Yes, yeah. But if you're making one up, you'd want to kind of check to see if it's being used for anything else. I mean, it's just a best practice, so you can find something that you can kind of use.
Search time
so let's see search what field. People are writing.
Lars Carlson, RT at EasyChur, easy fixes to common web number accessibility problems, by @top, http://bit.ly/pipes1l11y.axs.web.disk.html.
You might want to slow that down a little bit, Mecca, for people who aren't accustomed to iPhone speak.
Lars,
so listen to this one search again. It's a tweet, and it has usernames, or what were called the @mentions or replies. It has other hashtags besides number A11Y, and it has a URL.
Lars Carlson, RT at Easy Chirp, Easy Fixes to Common Web Number Accessibility Problems, by Aptop, http://bit/li/pipes1liter-number-web-number-11y-number-axs-number-web-disin-ht-at-revox, 23 minutes. Easy Chirp, Easy Fixes to Common Web Number Accessibility Problems, by Aptop, http.
So that's someone retweeted it before.
Beyond Umami, RT at Dan Prime, being unable to speak doesn't mean that an individual doesn't understand slash communicate, or can't think and reason, http://webox, 16 pixels for body copy, any, caption it right, read and link use number YouTube auto number captioning to write awesome gibberish script, http, disabled Canada, number did I off now that number Canada has many specific standards and laws pertaining to web number accessibility, number 11y, http://off/6qcrd, 52 minutes.
It was posted 52 minutes ago.
Care vacations. Did you know? October is number National Disability Employment Awareness Month. Number disabilities number AXS number 11Y number special needs http://bit. Gons underscore blinko. At Joan Marie, can you fill me in on meeting about floss number 11Y? 1 hour.
So Mika, every time you hear a number sign, the thing that follows that number sign is one of those hashtags?
Yeah, and so these are mostly different ones on accessibility.
Because some of those sound like they're just not even abbreviations, but for instance, like that number... What was it, number National Disability or something like that? It was something, it sounded like it was just a couple of more words that people would normally use anyway.
It could be. And then you might hear something like number UX, which would be user experience. They're just kind of commonly used.
When you hear one of those numbers, clicking on the number expands it?
Yeah, so let's, we can go back to that first one.
Lars Carlson, RT at Easy Chirp, Easy Fixes to...
Now, with this program TweetList, you can triple tap on a tweet to expose kind of like a context menu, like kind of like when you would right-click in Windows. So let's see what we have.
URL, HTTP, slash,
we have
slash
the URL.
For usernames.
So if we wanted to find out more about these people or follow them or read their tweets, we could do that.
Five hashtags.
So let's click on that and see what the different hashtags are.
Alert. Select accessibility. Button. Web. Button.
Accessibility web.
11Y. Button.
Number A11Y, that shortcut for accessibility.
AXS. Button.
That other one, AXS.
WebDesign. Button.
Let's spell this one.
Characters. W. B. B. D. E. S. I. G-N.
Web design. So let's double click on web design here, and then we'll get tweets with that hashtag.
Alert. Number web design. Search. Button. Tweet with hashtag. Button.
So you can either search or tweet with search. It. We'll button. Search.
Number web design. Pull down to refresh.
And PPH, it's updating.
PPH on PPH. Search. Number web design. Heading. Compose. Search. PPH underscore it underscore web. Open number job. Landing page required. Quick turnaround number web design number PPH HTTP / bit PPH underscore PPH market flow RT at Kiss Metrics. Five beautiful landing pages that prove great design still sells HTTP / Kiss. Lie / via 6 eyes number web design. 4 minutes. Sasha Blue at Beyond task completion. Flow in design HTTP / bit Lie / Msiki number web design number design. 5 minutes.
Most of these are referring to articles or other web pages. TweetList will open that in kind of an uncluttered way so you can read it.
Sasha Bluet, 25 inspiring, funny and strange quote wallpapers HTTP. USA, every web page is mobile ready. When simply you removed your stylish, it's number CSS, number CSS3, number HTML. 1556. Stat search. Back button.
God, we need Twitter for Dummies.
So the tweet is basically that 140 post, the 140 character post.
But how does that work? So you tweet or you read a tweet.
Yeah, the tweet is just the post. You go to...
Pipe, compose, button.
You go to compose.
New tweet, close, but new tweet, send. Piagola, 100, text field, Piagola, 140 chars left.
So this is that space where we could type in the 140 characters and it would go out to our followers.
Can we do a Twitter's for Dummies?
Like say,
2 of 5 cards, post, button.
Send it, what happens?
I could refer to the I could say, you know, demonstrating Twitter to @ViBugBoston, and then all of my followers would be able to read that, and then they'd be able to click on ViBugBoston as a username to read more about the group. The mentions are kind of people talking to you. So I've got that list up here now, and I'll read the first one here.
I3_14. Indeed, @Piatola. @Christmas. @MeganBerry. @SadDay4Tech. RIP Steve Jobs. http://gizmo. /page5bxdb. web19.15.9.
So that's Lindsay retweeting something I tweeted, which I think was a retweet about Steve Jobs. You know, but, and you hear that HTTP, you know that there's an article there. So we could read that if we wanted to using this client or another one.
The Kindle. Somebody mentioned the Kindle earlier today. The Kindle Fire, which is the newest Kindle, is coming out and it's got no better accessibility than the Kindle did before. So if you wanted to tweet that to a bunch of people and say, write to Kindle or call this number for Kindle to advocate, that's a really wonderful thing, because then if I tweet that to 10 other people who are interested in access advocacy, and then they tweet it to another 10 people or 100 people, it flies.
For instance, when it did come out, Pratik Patel in New York City sent out a tweet, and he said, everybody go and order the Kindle Fire and then cancel your order and write lack of accessibility.
Right.
So I posted, okay, I just put my order in, and then thank God I remembered to cancel it. But I wrote lack of accessibility for blind users, lack of non, you know, I tried to put as many key, I put reason for cancellation, other, and then I wrote this, so it
But it goes can, to people you set up, right? More or less if you were setting up an address book?
It
basically,
goes to people
people that are searching on a topic. If I posted about number accessibility, people wouldn't have to follow me. They could be searching on that topic and find it.
You don't have to, you know, it's not somebody you have to...
No, but you can approve. Like, I don't let anybody follow me who I don't approve. Somebody can... I've had people who wanted to follow me on Twitter, and I don't know them from anybody. I say no.
If there's a breaking news story, you can kind of find people that are right in the middle of the action and follow their tweets.
I just wasn't sure why this is necessarily better than email.
Oh, it is. It's just going to take some time to understand it, but once you do, you'll really get it. When I first came across things like Twitter and Foursquare, you know, it does take a little while to kind of figure out what it is and why would I use this and how would I use this.
So next month, Mecca, if you're here, we're going to do a We're gonna send some tweets back and forth so that people get a sense of what that's like.
Because a lot of people haven't actually seen this being done at all.
Right. So we need to. Yeah. So we'll do that from the ViBug Boston.
Okay.
And we'll tweet. Great. Thank you very much. And thanks, everybody. Thank you.